Hi everyone, welcome. I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. And tonight we are going to do the chapter Dr. Bob's Nightmare. For the next three times we meet, we're going to get into some AA doctors. This week we're doing Dr. Bob's Nightmare. Next week we will be doing the chapter Acceptance is the Answer, written by Dr. Paul, and we will be doing the doctor's opinion. So that's next Monday and Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern. But if y'all have your big books, we are on page 171, Dr. Bob's Nightmare. For those of you who aren't familiar, Dr. Bob was one of the co-founders with Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson actually 12-step carried the message to Dr. Bob. So this starts with his story and then how he received the message. So on page 171, he starts out by saying he had a good childhood. The general moral standard was above average and everything was pretty much fine. And this is really helpful, I think, for a couple of reasons, because a lot of times when we're in the illness, we say, I'm a compulsive eater because, and usually we want someone to blame, and usually it's our parents. If only my parents had raised me better, I wouldn't have this illness. But Dr. Bob's saying, no, I was raised just fine, and I still became an alcoholic. But, and lest you say, okay, well, that's Dr. Bob. Maybe he was raised fine, but I really and truly wasn't raised fine. We'll just take a walk over to page 544 in the chapter Freedom from Bondage, where the woman writing the story says, the medical profession would probably tell me I was conditioned for alcoholism by the things that happened to me in my childhood. And I'm sure they would be right as far as they go. But AA has taught me I am the result of the way I reacted to what happened to me. So again, this kind of gives us no excuses. It closes all the loopholes, whether we were raised in a great environment or in a less than ideal environment. In order to recover, we need to take responsibility for how we reacted to everything. And again, a good environment doesn't guarantee that everything will be fine. So I know for us moms out there, this is really helpful to know that parents could do everything right and still raise a child who's an addict, because becoming an addict or not becoming an addict isn't contingent on the right home environment. It's always contingent on our spiritual condition. And, you know, we'll see that more as we go along. So on the next page, page 172, Dr. Bob says, unfortunately for me, I was an only child, which perhaps engendered the selfishness, which played such an important part in bringing on my alcoholism. So here he talks about, okay, it wasn't my childhood, it was my selfishness. And that comports with what it says in the text section, right? Back on page 62, it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. So selfishness is the root. And I love this analogy from Herb Kay that in a plant or a tree, you don't see the roots underground, but you see the fruits. The fruits are resentments, fear, and harms to others. But we need to get rid of this illness at the roots. So here's Dr. Bob. He says, childhood through high school, I was taken to church. And he says, I didn't like it. So he said, I resolved I would never again darken the doors of a church unless it was beneficial to me to do so. So for him, I think he, that might have been his turning his back on God. And I thought about it for my own life, that I don't think I ever said, God, I turn my back on you. But I remember a time, this is the first time I can remember, I was very young. I was probably early grade school, and I had been made fun of often, and now the kids were making fun of someone else. And I knew what she felt. I had empathy at that point. And I joined in the teasing. And I think after that, my empathy eroded, my ability to be concerned with other people. I think for me, that was a moment where I just turned my back on what I knew to be right and good. And so there's Dr. Bob turning his back on church. So, and then he describes what his selfishness and self-centeredness looked like. And I love this definition, the bottom of page 172. My whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of anyone else, a state of mind which became more and more predominant. So isn't that interesting? So his spiritual condition started going downhill. And then he says his state of mind went downhill and got progressively worse. So not only does our food get progressively worse, but our thinking gets worse. Our ability to kind of analyze problems, to correctly grasp a situation, it gets worse. And he just, the next few pages just show it getting worse and worse. He barely makes it through college. He leaves one, goes to another. The bottom of page 174, I think he's out of college by now, out of medical school. And he says, by this time, I was beginning to pay very dearly. His alcoholism had progressed. He said, in hope of relief, I voluntarily incarcerated myself at least a dozen times in one of the local sanitariums. You imagine that? More than 12 times he had himself committed. So he wanted relief, but a couple things. He doesn't say, I wanted to stop for good and all. It was like, I want relief. I want a break, maybe. Or maybe he did want to stop for good and all, hard to discern. He was willing to go to great lengths, right? To lock yourself up in a mental hospital, especially when you're a doctor, what a blow to the ego, right? But he did it 12 times at least. But again, that's not the solution. To lock myself in a room away from food is not the solution. If I take penicillin for COVID-19, because I really want to get better from COVID, it's not going to make a difference because penicillin doesn't work for COVID. And just simply locking ourselves up doesn't work. And even when he was locked up, he says on page 175, I'd get my friends to smuggle me in some alcohol or I'd steal the alcohol. He had the desire to stop, right? Otherwise, he never would have had himself locked up, but he had no power. If we want it, we'll get it. I heard a woman at an OA convention stand up and say she had put herself in an eating disorder rehab and she sent herself a candy gram. I mean, when we want it, we're going to find a way to get it. Or rather, when the illness wants us to have it, there's going to be a way. Remember on page 8, Bill Wilson said, alcohol was my master. For me, food was my master. I had no choice. When it said binge, I had no choice but to binge. This went on for Dr. Bob. He got married and for 17 years, he continued drinking. He would stay sober just long enough to do some work so he could earn enough money to support his alcohol habit. And he would promise, bottom of page 177, he says, I used to promise my wife, my friends, and my children that I would drink no more. Promises which seldom kept me sober, even through the day, though I was very sincere when I made them. He couldn't get one day not one day. That was me sometimes. There were times I couldn't make it to lunch, couldn't do it. Why? Now, no one could say he didn't want to badly enough. Someone who commits themselves a dozen times wants to. But again, what does our book tell us? On page 24, it says that at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic or eating, right, of every compulsive eater, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. So he had a very strong desire to stop. It meant nothing. But of course, you know, how many times have people said to us, oh, if you really wanted to stop binging, you could. Well, no one ever goes up to a cancer patient and says, if you really wanted to make your cancer cells stop multiplying, you could. But yet with us, it's not recognized, but it's a disease where desire alone doesn't do it. So here he is, 17 years going along. And then he hears about a group that, that's got a good spiritual thing going, page 178. It's the Oxford group. And he says he was attracted to this group because of their seeming poise, health, and happiness. Those are good marks of a recovery group. And we should all ask ourselves individually, and as members of groups we're in, do we exhibit that poise, like a confidence, but not based on how great I am, but based on how great my God is. I can trust my God. I have confidence in my God. And health. We can't always control it, but you know, we want to appear healthy. We wear lipstick to meetings. You know, we don't want to appear dour, right? And happiness. Life isn't always a bed of roses, but we're not in the food. Our families are generally being restored. You know, our careers are being restored. Our lives are being restored. There is plenty to be happy about. So Dr. Bob was there and he said, they seemed to be happy. I sensed they had something I didn't, from which I might profit. And I learned it was something of a spiritual nature, he said, which didn't appeal to me. But he was open-minded. And he says for 2.5 years, he pursued this like kind of spiritual remedy, this spiritual reading. And I mean, I can remember reading spiritual literature and binging, right? If I'm reading a book on insulin and I'm a diabetic, but I don't stick the insulin in my arm, I could read all the books on insulin I want. I'm not going to get better. But this isn't in the book, but something interesting that Dr. Bob did when he was at the Oxford groups is they were all sharing their problems one night. And he said, okay, guys, I have something to tell you. I'm an alcoholic. And, or I don't know if they use that term, but I can't stop drinking. I drink too much. And they were all, you know, like once it's like, yes, Bob, you're not telling us anything we didn't know. And they prayed for him. They prayed. So tuck that in the back of your mind, because in a page or so, that's going to be important. They prayed for him. And so here he is. He's reading. He's going to meetings, but no surrender. And he says, but his wife kept going. And that it was her faith and courage that was the reason he wasn't dead. And whenever I hear the word courage, you know, the first time I ever heard that word, probably like all of us, right, was where? In The Wizard of Oz, right? The cowardly lion, that he wanted courage. He continued on his journey, even though he had fear. Now, he needed his friend's help. I think that's what courage is, doing the right thing, even in the face of fear. So his wife had courage and she had faith. My faith can help another person. My faith can actually do something, because remember, faith is a key. in the spiritual kingdom. It's a catalyst to make things happen. Money is currency in the physical world. Faith activated by prayer. And we know that Dr. Bob's wife prayed is a currency in the spiritual world. I had a family member with whom I've had a rift for about a month and a half now, someone who I think wasn't the nicest to me. And I hadn't really prayed for this person in a while. And this morning I prayed. I prayed for a restoration of the relationship. And the person called me today and we spoke for over an hour, and the relationship is on its way to being restored. Now, if I hadn't prayed, would that person have called? I don't know. But I like to think that our God is a God who wants restoration and healing among relationships. And so I choose to believe that my prayer might have been the thing that, you know, what's that game where you have the straw that broke the camel's back? I don't like to refer, not that God is a camel and I broke his back, but it was the catalyst that made things happen. That maybe God is up there wanting to do these awesome things for us and is just waiting for us to pray them out, like taking a deposit out of a bank. And so Dr. Bob's wife prayed and got results. And I know today I prayed and got results. So she prayed, and what happened? We're at page 179, and it talks about a woman calls Dr. Bob's wife and says, bring him over. And it was someone he knew, someone in the Oxford group. And in fact, her name was Henrietta. She was the woman who had prayed for him. Well, that was 2 weeks ago. But on this night, at the same time, it was spoken about last week, there's Bill Wilson, just happens to be in the same town that Dr. Bob is. And things weren't going well for him. Page 154. We see Bill in a hotel room, away from home, bitterly discouraged, in a strange place, discredited, almost broke, physically weak, newly sober, in a lawsuit, and he knew his predicament was dangerous. So what did he do? He says, he's thinking, should I drink? And it says he didn't. His sanity returned and he thanked God. I am sure in there, Bill prayed. And so he sees this phone booth with the directory of local churches, six churches. The first five, nothing. The sixth one, he gets an answer and he says to the guy, I need an alcoholic to help. And he says, oh yeah, I think Henrietta and her group do something with alcoholics. I'll give you her number. He calls Henrietta, and she answers the phone and he says, hi, my name's Bill. I'm in from out of town. I'm looking for an alcoholic to help. And she says, we've been waiting for you. We've been waiting for you. She prayed for Bob. She had faith. And so when Bill called, it wasn't like, oh my gosh, what's this? It's just like, we've been waiting for you. Like, I knew you'd come. So Henrietta talks to Dr. Bob's wife and says, bring him on over tomorrow. And Dr. Bob, he is drunk that day. And his wife says, we're going tomorrow. He's drunk. He has no intention of stopping drinking. He's like, we're going for 15 minutes and that's it. They were there for 6 hours and 15 minutes. This 12-step call lasted 6 hours and 15 minutes. And Bill and Bob talked. And they talked for a bit afterwards. And it's interesting to see, again, back in the chapter of Vision for You, what they talked about. he related his experience and to Dr. Bob, told him he needed a spiritual experience, but told him about himself and how he used to drink. And Dr. Bob said, "I agree. The spiritual experience is necessary, but the price is high, and I'll do anything except go to the people who I make my livelihood from, like the people in the community who might be patients." He said, "I will do anything but that." So we have to ask ourselves, what's our but that? I will do anything but that. And what happened with Dr. Bob's but that? He made a good start. He didn't get 30 days. With 3 weeks later, he's drinking again. A couple things here. First, back then, you say, well, why did Bill start working with them? They didn't have the 12 steps then. They didn't have any steps then, right? Bill was just doing what he knew, trying to work with another alcoholic. Now we've learned, and it's on page 58 of our book, that if someone isn't willing to go to any lengths, it won't work. They didn't know that at the time, but Dr. Bob sure learned that. And the other thing, Bill did not say to Dr. Bob, "Get 48 hours sober and then come back and talk to me." He met him where he was and he supported him where he was. So that's what we generally believe, is that people who are wiser than I am may say that no, people need 2 days or 3 days. That's not my understanding of this book. If Bill had done that with Dr. Bob, none of us would be sitting here on Zoom tonight. We'd like be watching Friends reruns or something. But there he was. He said he would do anything but that. And then what happened? Within 3 weeks, he's drunk. And what did Bill do? Did he say, "You know what, you're going to have to find someone new to help you. I can't help you. I gave you 3 weeks of my time and now you're out drinking." He didn't. He actually came and got him where he was. He put him to bed. I mean, think how tender that is. One grown man putting another grown man to bed, you know, taking off his shoes, his feet probably smelled, probably hadn't showered, brushed his teeth in a couple days. He put him to bed. He cared. He was tender with him. And that was it. But what happened when we say that was it? Was that just it? Now, again, we have to go back to the chapter, A Vision for You. And what happened? Dr. Bob saw that when he got, when he woke up the next day, he saw this was the spree that ended all sprees. He saw he would have to face his problems squarely, that God might give him mastery. Again, I believe this is from Herb Kay. Your feet show what you believe. He may have, Roger's telling me, yes, that's a Herb. Your feet show what you believe. So he believed God could help him, but now he had to walk the talk. And so what did he do? He set out to tell those he feared what his trouble had been. He made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled, for this might mean ruin to a person in his line of business. So what do we see there? He didn't delay. He made the rounds. So that means it was more than one or two people. It was a lot of people. So guys, when we're making our amends, we want to make the rounds and get them done quickly. He trembled. We do this even if it's going to cost us. He was afraid it might cost him his job. But what other option did he have? If he kept drinking, he wasn't going to keep his job. So he did it. And he says, "That was June 10th, 1935. And that was my last drink." And he says, as I write, nearly 4 years have passed. And we know that he stayed sober until his death. So he says, okay, now the question you're probably asking is, what did this man, Bill, do or say that was different from anything that what other people had done? And he said, I had read a lot. I talked to everyone who knew or thought they knew about alcoholism, but this was different. He says, why? He says, well, he gave me information about alcoholism, which was undoubtedly helpful. So this tells us when we're trying to work with someone, we have to give information about this illness, about the strange mental twist, you know, so we say like the broken bridge, why we're unable to remember how the horrors of the last binge, when we say this time I'm just going to have one, we need to be able to understand that. So he said that, but he said, but what was more important is he was the first person who knew what he was talking about from actual experience. And I say, why is that important, right? If I had a therapist who understood compulsive eating, would that work? And they're saying there's something different. He talked my language. So it may be a couple of reasons. And one may be no one's going to get it the way another person who's had the same illness will get it. They may understand it in a textbook way, but not in a heart way. And if someone used to be, if someone binged the way that I was binging and then wasn't, I could trust them and I could feel safe with them. So that's all on a psychological level. But I'm going to submit that there may be something more. On page 164 of the book, it says, you know, God will constantly disclose more to you. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. Because obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. So, okay, they're telling me to pray for the person who's still sick. And then they're telling me I need to be able to transmit something. It says, see to it that your relationship with him, God, is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. So in the middle of this whole section about our morning meditation, our morning prayer, making sure my relationship with God is right, they throw in that line, you cannot transmit something you don't have. And almost like, why is it there? So I looked up the definition of transmission, and it's something, heat, light, sound, electricity, or other energy passes through a medium, right? Like sound waves travel through a phone. If we're in good spiritual condition, we are transmitting something. We are transmitting something more than good information. We are transmitting something of spiritual power. It is a sacred responsibility and a sacred privilege to carry this message. And so Henrietta, I mean, she was a great spiritual woman, right? She sat there and she prayed, and she wasn't even surprised when her prayers were answered, but she couldn't transmit to Bob the way that Bill could. She couldn't transmit spiritual healing from alcoholism. Guys, our relationship with God has to be right so we can transmit to others. And then what does he say? Dr. Bob continues on, bottom of page 180. It is a most wonderful blessing to be relieved of this terrible curse. Look, he doesn't talk in psychological terms, right? He talks in spiritual terms. Curse, blessing. And notice the passive voice. I've been relieved. He didn't relieve himself. God relieved him. God gave him the blessing. And then he just said, okay, I'm not cursed with alcoholism anymore. And by the way, here's all these bonuses I got. I got my health. I got my home life and I have my business, which is good, even in these uncertain times. Oh, and I have my respect and the respect of others. And then he kind of gives us some instructions by telling us what he does. He says, I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want it and need it. A great deal of time. That's not 10 minutes a day. A great deal of time. At the beginning of the story, it says that in 15 years, he carried the message to 5,000 people. So I'm going to quick do the math here. That's 333 and a third people a year. That's almost a person a day that he carried this message to, a great deal of time. And then he said why he does it, a sense of duty. Yeah, that at first. And then it's a pleasure. And I think that's interesting. The more we grow spiritually, the more what we have to do and what we want to do are the same. The more we grow spiritually, the more what we have to do and what we want to do are the same. May start out a duty, it becomes a pleasure. And then he says, when I do so, I'm paying my debt to Bill Wilson. Gratitude. Gratitude is demonstrable. We can see it. It shows. And he also says, as we all know, it's insurance. You know, if we're not sponsoring, you know, it's like we're driving a car in a storm with no insurance. Yeah, we may get lucky and not have a crash, but I don't ever want to risk that. And then he says something which I think is a bit sad. He says, unlike most people, I didn't get over my craving for liquor much during my first 2.5 years of abstinence. It was almost always with me. You know how sad, this man who worked so hard, giving to others, and the craving was there. Now, I can feel sorry for him, but he certainly didn't feel sorry for himself, and we can't feel sorry for ourselves. He says, but at no time have I been anywhere near yielding. God protected him, even though he had that craving. He was protected. And he says, I used to get upset. I saw people drinking when I couldn't, but he took responsibility. He said, I schooled myself to believe that though I once had the same privilege, I had abused it so frightfully, it was withdrawn, right? If someone gets in too many car accidents, they're going to lose the privilege to drive. He saw he'd abuse the privilege of drinking. He didn't have it anymore. And he said, okay, I'm okay with that. Didn't love it, but he was okay with it. And then he says, doesn't behoove me to squawk about it. No one had to throw me down and pour liquor down my throat. He took responsibility and had no self-pity. And then he says, like, just a really cool line. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what's in this book. And then he doesn't sit there and explain why they should believe in God. He just says, I feel sorry for you. But what I think is interesting is he says, if you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, or a skeptic, what does that mean? Like, can we think we're an atheist, agnostic, or skeptic and not really be one? I think so. I think he's right. Because page 55, it says, my favorite line, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That it may be obscured by calamity, pomp, worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. It's there. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. How did it get there, deep down inside of all of us? There's only one way, right? When God created us and gave us like one heart, two lungs, one liver, two kidneys, the fundamental idea of himself. He planted that right in there. Dr. Bob says, you got to get that. He says, if you still think you're strong enough to beat the game alone, that's your affair, right? If someone says, I can do it on my own, I don't need help, that's fine. We wish them well. But if you really and truly want to quit for good and all, see the difference back before he said he incarcerated himself in hope of relief. But now he's saying you need to want to quit for good and all and sincerely feel you must have some help. We know we have an answer. This book has an answer. And then he gives a conditional promise. It never fails. That means 0% of the time it fails. If and only if you go about it with one half the zeal you've been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink. I know the zeal I was showing to binge, walking the streets at 2 a.m, streets in New York City to get food with my rent money. If I had to be a little or a lot inconvenienced to recover, I schooled myself to believe that's the price I had to pay. And then he ends with a promise that isn't conditional, and which those of us who've worked this program have all found to be true. Your Heavenly Father, our Heavenly Father, will never let us down.